From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is The Local Edition, and I'm Jason Dolb. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight. Coming up, we do have a double dose of post-budget analysis as we continue to delve into New York State's super late $268 billion budget. We're finding out what it means for New Yorkers, finding out about how it impacts the issues that may impact your life. And to do it, we're talking to our news partners at New York Focus. In the second half of our program, we check in with Sam Mellons, their senior reporter, about housing. Specifically, whether changes to New York's half-century-old environmental review law will help confront the state's housing crisis as lawmakers intend. And in a moment, I will be talking to Chris Gilardi, New York Focus Justice Bureau Chief. I'll have a big conversation about what's in the budget for New York's prisons and for prison reform. And I'll let you know now, there was a lot more money in the budget for one of those items than the other. But before we get into budget analysis, let's do a quick update on data centers in our area, starting with the observation that Pennsylvania and New York are taking very different approaches to this issue. In his major budget address in February, Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro touted both the importance of building data centers and the importance of protecting local communities and resources from data centers. Now, with Pennsylvania's June 30th budget deadline less than a month away, we're getting a clearer picture of where Governor Shapiro stands. His office has released a full, detailed version of its proposed incentives for data center developers. The plan would require data centers to mitigate their impacts on the environment and electric grid in order to receive a major state tax exemption and other incentives. A spokesperson for the administration told our news partners at Spotlight PA that these standards are a, quote, important part of broader conversations as budget negotiations continue. WHYY's Zoe Reed reports on the plan, which Shapiro's office is calling the Governor's Responsible Infrastructure Development, or GRID.
Power-hungry data centers are popping up to meet the demand for artificial intelligence, but the facilities use a lot of energy, leading to higher electricity bills for everyone. They also use millions of gallons of water to prevent servers from overheating. Shapiro's plan would create a pathway for data center development by offering tax incentives and a streamlined permitting process. But those perks would only be available to data centers that pay for their own energy use. They'd also have to reduce their impacts on the environment, create at least 200 construction jobs, and invest in community programs. State lawmakers would need to pass legislation to implement the governor's proposed standards. From the Climate Desk, Zoe Reed, WHYY News.
And a reminder, as we talk about data centers in Pennsylvania, there are plans for a data center and power generation development in Wayne County's Clinton Township. It could include 20 data center buildings. Those plans will be discussed at a regular meeting of the Clinton Township Planning Commission tonight. It's happening in Forest City, PA, coming up at 7. Meanwhile, in New York State, similar proposals are getting a very different reception from officials. As artificial intelligence data centers are being proposed throughout New York, state and local lawmakers are seeking to regulate them, with some even eyeing a moratorium that would be the first of its kind in the nation. New York Public News Network's Sagina Shrestha reports.
The New York Independent System Operator, which manages the state's electric grid, says 51 large data load projects have made requests for electricity as of May of this year. That's up from 6 requests in 2022. As concerns grow over power and water usage, New York State lawmakers are considering a one-year moratorium on data center permits. Bill co-sponsor Senator Pat Fahey, an Albany Democrat, said the moratorium seeks to ensure the facility's demand for power doesn't impact ratepayers.
They take a lot of energy, a lot of electricity and power. That often ends up on the ratepayers. We have seen deals cut all over this country to bring data centers in, and it goes on the backs of ratepayers.
The New York State Legislature will wrap its regular session on Thursday. For the New York Public News Network, I'm Sagina Shrestha.
Thank you, Sagina. Well, now we're going to get into how New York State's budget is impacting issues in the state. Now, this week, we're diving into the details, key issue by key issue, and coming up, we'll look at housing. But first tonight, let's take a look at criminal justice, specifically looking at the state's prison system, which, pretty much all parties, from the incarcerated and their families to corrections officers and corrections officials to state lawmakers, all parties pretty much agree the state prison system is in turmoil, if not in crisis, never fully recovering from the statewide prison strikes that ended more than a year ago. This year's budget gives state prisons a major boost with more than $500 million in new funding, but funding for prison oversight is much less certain. New York Focus has been reporting on how the budget handles both sides of that equation. Joining us now is Chris Gilardi, Justice Bureau Chief at New York Focus, who's been following the budget, the prison system, and the debate over oversight. And he's been talking to us throughout this budget process. Chris, welcome back to Radio Catskill.
Hey, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
So for listeners who may not have followed this issue that closely, what's the big prison-related story in this year's state budget?
Yeah, as you mentioned, the prison system has been pretty much in crisis for well over a year now. There has been a lot of staffing issues. There have been a lot of complaints over conditions related to those staffing issues. And, you know, as the prison system recovers from the 3-week-long corrections officers strike that took place last year, in just like the legislature and Albany in general, there have been sort of like two tracks of addressing that. One is, you know, give the prison system the resources that it needs to staff up, to make sure that, you know, all units have like the staffing that they need to make sure that operations are running smooth right now on the day to day. And then there's, you know, sort of other track of like prison reformers who have pointed to like the current and ongoing crisis as sort of like evidence that, you know, reforms that they've been sort of pushing for a long time are really needed. And so you see those sort of like two tracks happening kind of simultaneously, both in this year's sort of just like general legislative session and in the state budget. So the first like main thing that happened in the state budget related to prisons and related to addressing this crisis is a big pot of about $500 million, $535 million that the state can use to quote unquote stabilize the prison system. I gather just, you know, from just what's in the air and sort of like what the state has been using of similar pots of money for, that a lot of that will be going to the National Guard. We might remember that last year when the prison strike launched, Governor Kathy Hochul sent the National Guard into the prisons to like help the few remaining officers in the facilities staff them and ride out the crisis. And she's kept them in there like for the entirety of like the post-strike period. Last year, they spent about $700 million on National Guard troops in the facilities. Unclear how much of this $535 million will go to the National Guard, but since they're still in there and they'll be in there for the foreseeable future, although probably a reduced force, it's probably safe to assume that a big chunk of that will be going, to National Guard, continuing to help the facilities.
So $700 million on National Guard last year, and you would say that it seems likely that some of this $535 million will also still be going to National Guard.
Yeah, I think it's highly likely. And it's important to point out, like, this $535 million is on top of the prison agency's just like normal annual budget. You know, it's about a $4 billion agency. So they still have all of their money to like operate. And this is an extra pot of money that will likely go to a lot of the National Guard, but is just meant for things to allow the prison system to like to keep itself stable during this period of crisis.
Yeah. Do you know of any other details on what that money might go for?
You know, I don't. And I have been meaning to ask the prison agency about this. The way that the budget line is written, it's pretty open-ended. It's like state money. So yeah, it's like separate from DOCS's annual budget, but it really just requires the prison commissioner to submit a plan and then the state budget director to approve that plan, and they can use it for anything that they can, you know, reasonably justify as like stabilizing the correctional system.
Yeah, it's not pending review of the plan. Those are just the steps they have to take to utilize the funds that have already been allocated.
Exactly.
Okay, so what about that other side of the equation that you're mentioning, that, you know, that other track, which is about oversight?
Yeah, so there's a bunch of things happening here. The main thing that's going on in the state budget is so last year there's this organization. It's called the Correctional Association of New York. It's technically a nonprofit, but it's given special powers by the state legislature to oversee and like conduct inspections of state prisons. It's a very old agency. It dates back to the 1800s, actually. So it's not a governmental agency, but it sort of functions like one. Even though it sort of functions like a governmental agency, traditionally it's been funded through like foundations and outside funding with a little bit of government money here and there. As part of the reform push last year, the state legislature succeeded in getting about $3 million for the Correctional Association in government money, which really boosted its funding and allowed it to expand. And since then, I've been talking to leadership of the Correctional Association quite a bit over the past year, and they've described a really promising effort to work with prison staff to not only, you know, like interview them and interview incarcerated people and issue reports on like conditions in the facilities, which is like a main thing that it is traditionally done, but also to work with staff and incarcerated people to identify like key indicators of what they think are like signifiers of good conditions and sort of like a successfully run prison. And they've described this sort of exciting sort of dialogue process that they're having to come up with like plans to improve conditions, bringing staff together with incarcerated people and their experts. And that's what they've been using sort of this $3 million for over the last year. The Correctional Association was operating under the assumption that $3 million would be recurring. They hired permanent people and created like plans for these programs that would extend beyond the fiscal year that just ended. But in the budget, in Kathy Hochul's original budget proposal, it didn't include that money. It didn't include that $3 million, which would pretty much squash these programs. And there was a lot of like back and forth between legislators and the governor's office, as I understand it. And the final state budget, it includes $2 million, so not quite the full amount, in its actual sort of like line items that are dedicated to the Correctional Association. But the Correctional Association has said that both people from the governor's office and leadership in the state assembly have assured them that the extra $1 million will be coming through a different process, through a different appropriations process. But it's all a little bit unclear. So you know, they have these programs and they're sort of moving forward with these programs, but and they're very much hoping that they're going to get that $1 million and are able to continue them in full force. But it's been a bit of a fight to ensure that they're able to keep their efforts going in the same at the same clip that they were last year.
So just to make sure I'm understanding this, it's clear that just on the budget side of things, the Correctional Association in New York will be getting less than it got last year, but it's not clear if they will still be getting those funds in another way.
Exactly. That's a little bit TBD.
As I understand it, there's only like one day left to the legislative year. Is that correct?
That's correct. So that's another issue. I do think so that extra $1 million will be, I believe there are like many mechanisms that can, that they can get that money like outside of like the legislative process. You know, the governor's office and the legislature have pots of money that they can funnel other places that don't need legislation, so that might not be an issue. But yeah, you do touch on another sort of like core thing that is happening, you know, in all realms of state government, but on criminal justice as well, which is that anything that didn't make it into the state budget, they only have a few days to pass all of that stuff, and because the state budget was almost 2 months late this year. It's a mad dash. I've been trying to follow all of the criminal justice legislation that is or isn't going to be passed by the time the legislature is set to leave this week. And yeah, it's been a bit of a frenzy.
I mean, yeah, I think you're kind of already answering the question I was going to ask, because is there any like last minute Hail Mary legislation lined up? I mean, whatever legislation people are trying to pass right now, it's all kind of last minute Hail Mary stuff. And you're just trying to wend your way through it.
Exactly, exactly. So there were a couple things in that the legislature wanted to include in the state budget that they're now trying to pass as individual legislation. One is, it's called the CARE Act. It would establish a Bill of Rights for pregnant incarcerated people. And that, I believe, has passed the Senate, but not the Assembly. Then there was a proposal to order the State Commission of Correction, which is another oversight body, to hire a chief medical examiner to conduct independent investigations into more independent investigations into jail and prison deaths. That the future of that is unclear. There's a lot of reform legislation when it comes to sentencing and parole to get people out of prison faster. That is all very up in the air. So the picture is really unclear, and we won't really know what is going to pass and what won't until the legislature goes home for the year.
Right. And that's going to be very soon. Are you getting any feeling, is this set in stone, the end of this legislative session, or is there a possibility of any kind of like extension?
Some of my colleagues would be better able to answer that question. I wouldn't put it past the legislature to extend this session. You know, it's a little bit arbitrary why the state legislature is only in session for 6 months of the year. In other states, it's much closer to a year-round session. So I think that's definitely a possibility, but we'll have to see.
As we wrap up this conversation, Chris, I mean, part of what you're looking at is just the nuts and bolts of like what passed, what didn't, what are people trying to pass, you know, what are advocates calling for. But when you look at the bigger picture, part of what you're also doing is just telling the story of criminal justice in New York State. So big picture, what does this budget process, from the hearings that you first attended to now the thing has been signed and done, what does it tell you about Albany's priorities and the narrative when it comes to prisons, staffing, and accountability?
I really appreciate this question. I think this budget season specifically, if we're just talking about prison specifically, there's other criminal justice stuff that's going on. But there was a moment after the strike last year and after the two very high-profile killings of incarcerated people by corrections officers when there was a lot of energy and potential for some of the reforms that, you know, the very big prison reform movement and very dedicated prison reform movement in New York State had been pushing for years. Last year, there was a lot of openness from people, namely Governor Kathy Hochul, who aren't part of that movement and who traditionally are a bit skeptical of aggressive reforms, to pass them. And there were some passed last year. We saw that energy significantly dwindle this year. And I think anything that didn't pass this year will have an increasingly difficult time passing next year, barring some sort of unforeseen, similar political moment like we saw last year.
All right. Well, your article is up now at nysfocus.com. Chris Gilardi, Justice Bureau Chief for New York Focus. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much again.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
It is The Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. And now, as we continue looking at issues impacted by New York State's budget, it's time to get a lot more detail on a story that we first brought to your attention last week. In case you missed it, last Wednesday on The Local Edition, I brought Philip Pantuso, Times Union Hudson Valley, on air a full day earlier than usual because he had breaking news in the waning hours of the New York State budget process that lawmakers were moving to change a major environmental review law in an effort to speed up new housing construction. The State Environmental Quality Review Act, known as CEQRA, has been around for decades. It requires many development projects to study and disclose their potential environmental impacts before moving forward. Now it's a week later. The budget has passed. Governor Hochul has signed the budget into law, and we know most new housing projects will soon be exempt from that review process. To learn more about housing, housing development, and what impact changes to CECRA may have on the housing crisis, Radio Catskill's Rebecca Hendricks spoke with New York-focused senior reporter Sam Mellons.
Sam, welcome to Radio Catskill.
Hi, Rebecca. Good to be with you.
So, Sam, for listeners who might not be familiar, what is CECRA?
Basically, what it is a law that has existed since 1976 that says for all kinds of new construction projects, there needs to be a detailed study about how it will change the environment, whether it will have negative effects, if so, how those effects will be mitigated, and that needs to happen before the project can go forward.
What are the changes to CECRA that are included in this year's state budget?
The changes are really significant. Basically, what they'll do is exempt most new housing statewide, though not all, from the law, and sort of depending on where in the state it is. Like in rural areas, only very small new developments. In urban areas or New York City, much larger ones will be allowed to be exempt. And also certain other types of development, like in parks or for public schools, will be exempt from the law generally.
Why has CECRA become such a big part of the housing debate in New York State?
Governor Hochul has really brought it to the fore as something that she says has prevented housing growth in the state. The state has a major housing shortage. Rents are high, mortgages are high, a lot of people are being priced out. And what the governor has said, the case that she's made, and many experts agree with her, is that the review requirements are so onerous and they can be used in lawsuits trying to block new housing that it makes it much more expensive to build and exacerbates the state's housing issue.
So you said before that there are certain projects that are exempt from CECRA under this budget deal. What do those housing projects look like?
So it really varies tremendously depending on where you are in the state. So in the densest parts of New York City, buildings will be presumed to be exempt up to 500 apartments. And then it gets smaller if you're in a smaller city, down to in relatively undeveloped areas outside of, you know, urban or suburban areas, only buildings up to 20 apartments will be eligible for the exemption. So that's meant to sort of keep it tailored to the housing needs and the infrastructure realities of the different parts of the state.
What are housing advocates saying about this change?
Housing advocates are really pretty enthusiastic about it. I think a lot of them feel that New York politicians have not been taking the housing crisis seriously at a statewide level. And this feels like one of the first major changes in recent years that actually does that. I'll just, you know, read one sample quote from the article from Vicky Bean, who's a real housing expert and professor at New York University. She said, "When everyone is looking for ways to bring down the cost of housing, this is a critical step." So that sort of captures it.
Okay. And what on the other side are environmental groups concerned about?
Some environmental groups were opposed to these changes. Said it's an essential planning tool. It said it was a false choice between housing and environmental protection. So that's definitely a perspective that exists. But other environmental groups supported the changes because what they do is they incentivize people to build bigger in areas that are already developed, like New York City or, you know, other cities around the state, by removing this obstacle. And they disincentivize people from building in areas that are not developed because undeveloped areas are not eligible for this exemption. It would still need to go through the full environmental review process. So it would be more expensive to build there relative to somewhere that has already seen development. So for that reason, a lot of environmental groups actually supported the change.
Okay, interesting. So how would this have an impact in places like the Hudson Valley, Catskills, or smaller communities upstate that are more agricultural or maybe underdeveloped?
Right. So I think in, you know, the sort of the small cities or you know, major towns of the Hudson Valley, you could see this making it easier to develop apartment-style housing. And it would, you know, remove this lever that has been used to delay it if towns don't want to allow the housing, or, you know, sometimes people even file lawsuits, and then you, if you want to have a successful development, you have to have the budget to hire lawyers, and, you know, it gets to be a whole mess. So, you know, there could be more development coming to places like, you know, Hudson, New Paltz, for example, Kingston, whatever it may be. But in sort of more agricultural areas, I think you actually won't see very much of a change. Land that is currently used for agriculture is actually not, the changes do not apply to that land. The environmental review law still applies as it did before, and the review process is still in effect. So that, I think, the status quo there is pretty untouched.
So it sounds like this could really build up a lot of new housing across the state. So how does it fit into the larger housing crisis in New York?
One thing that I think is important to note is that a lot of places in New York, particularly the suburbs of New York City, don't want to add housing. They're, you know, if someone proposes an apartment building in certain towns in Long Island or Westchester, there's, you know, big town meetings in opposition. People say it will increase traffic, it will overcrowd the schools, you know, so on. And this won't change anything about that. If towns want to block new housing, they can still use their local zoning codes to do that. But for places that want to build, for places that want to add housing and give people you know, different options, this will make it easier for them to do that. And some places in the state definitely have been looking to lower the obstacles in that regard.
So Sam, looking to the future, what should people watch for next as these secret changes are put into practice?
I think it'll be interesting to see whether we see more apartment-style housing coming to some of these mid-size and smaller cities in the state where sort of the medium level of the changes applies, not buildings as big as in New York City, but also bigger than the ones that are going to be allowed in less developed areas. We could see a sort of boom in mid-rise apartment building coming to the, you know, sort of medium population density areas of the state.
Interesting. So we'll have to see moving forward what this does for the housing crisis in New York State. Sam, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was Sam Mellons, senior reporter with New York Focus, speaking with us about changes to the State Environmental Quality Review Act in New York's final state budget. You can find out more on this story at newyorkfocus.com or our website, wjffradio.org. In Liberty, I'm Rebecca Hendricks for Radio Catskill.
Big thanks to Rebecca Hendricks for that report. And thank you for being here with me for the Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole, and that is it for tonight's episode. You want to stay with us because coming up at 7, we kick off a great evening full of music, 2 hours retro cocktail hour, followed by virtual soundscapes with Matt Hurtado. But before any of that, we do have more news on the way from The Daily. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Never Sink General Store, featuring catering for parties, meetings, and weddings, gourmet deli, pizzeria, and groceries inside a gas station. NeverSinkGeneralStore.com. From Rourke Law Liberty, New York, a general law practice serving the Catskills and Delaware River Valley with an emphasis on estate planning, estate administration, elder law, and real property matters. RourkeLaw.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
This week's Retro Cocktail Hour takes you on a nonstop staycation with tunes by Sergio Mendes and Brazil 66, the Michel Legrand Orchestra, and the new exotic sounds of Mark Riddle. I'm Daryl Brogdon. The music is always shaken, not stirred, on the Retro Cocktail Hour. Coming up tonight, it's